ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate it. Rate, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about Serena Williams at Wimbledon. Also, youth basketball seems to be destroying the bodies of the kids who play it. But first. Hey, man. Russell Westbrook going to play for the Rockets. Chris Paul, we don't know where the hell he's going to play. They traded him to Oklahoma City. And it's funny because he has like a warm spot in his heart for Oklahoma City. Because remember when he first came to the league, that's where they played. You know what I'm saying? Like that was, it ain't that warm though. He's like, yeah, okay, man, I did this once. That don't mean I'm doing it again. And Oklahoma City is kind of like, this dude does make $45 million. What exactly are we going to do from here? But now that move got made, and they say Westbrook is on board with it to go down there and play with James Harden. I imagine he is. He's the super loyal dude that decided to re-sign that extension with Oklahoma City. But it is interesting. Our thing was, he's staying here. He ain't going nowhere. It is very clear, though, that that was always on the contingency that, by the way, I've only played for one bad team since I've been here. The first time that there was a legitimate reason to think that this team would not be bad, he's like, nah, I'm cool, trade me. It's all right. You straight. Like, every time we start talking about these teams and loyalty and everything else, let us remember, these dudes ain't so loyal to these teams. Not that they necessarily should be, but every time somebody gets weepy about the fact that teams not been loyal to somebody, Russ thought all that noise about loyalty, and then when it started looking a little grim, he was like, nah, I want to leave too. This ain't what I thought I was signing up for. I want to get out of here. And now he winds up going down there to Houston for an arrangement with James Harden that I think we would all agree doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I've heard people try to make the argument that they think Russ can kind of make them better than Chris Paul did. Okay, I guess. My question, though, how does this make sense? Is their offense going to be the same that it's basically been for the last year and a half where James Harden does it all? And then every now and then you get a chance to do something. Or when it is your chance to do something, it's because James Harden wants a rest and so he's just standing over 30 feet from the basket not doing anything? Like, does that sound like what Russell Westbrook wants? Does this sound like playing 4-on-5 basketball is a great idea with Russell Westbrook out there? Do you think that there's a value in Russell Westbrook standing there off the ball? What do you think he over there doing, waiting to take open threes? What, you think Russ is going to be standing there in the corner like, yo, I'm dead-eye at this? Is that how you think this is going to wind up playing? Because I don't think this is how this is going to wind up playing. I feel like we wound up in a situation where basically James Harden was like, all right, this dude don't want to play with me no more. I don't really like this dude neither. Why don't you get him up out of here and trade for my homeboy? And they were homeboys, and they did play on the same team together 7 years ago. This feels very much so like a couple cats that was cool in college talking about, well, man, we can live together and be just like the old days. So y'all been living a whole lot of life since this happened. Is this really a pairing that's supposed to go? And you tell me this, Gabe. I'm curious what you think here. Because we got the Lakers. Anthony Davis just got introduced and everything else. And I think that most of us probably believe that the Lakers are going to give us more content to make shows out of in this game. Right? Nobody was going to get more of them than the Lakers because you got Anthony Davis and then figuring that team out. I feel like the Rockets are going to give us more to talk about than anybody else. What about you?
Dude, I'm so excited for this team to see the two of them play with one another again and Russ play around a team of different kinds of parts than he got in OKC.
Yeah, I saw somebody make an interesting point, though, about Fertitta, the owner. Who I've told you, he is the big booster for the University of Houston. And I feel like in order to understand him, you got to think of him in the context of being a booster, right? But what people were telling me about him is what he really cares about is stars, like wattage. That's the thing that really gets him going. And that's why you wind up in a situation where Trevor Ariza and Luka Mbamute come up on their deals. And he's like, nah, get them out of here because they not stars. Stars is what he's here for. And so what Russell Westbrook was another star. Like, there's one star we got in making it work. Cool. Let's go out here and get another star. Now Fertitta is showing a little bit more of a willingness to pay the luxury tax. But I find it very, very interesting that a guy who at once is not so interested in paying the luxury tax would also be a guy that isn't interested in, like, the lower tier players that you have to get to fill out your roster if you don't want to pay the luxury tax. Like, that's the cat that we got here. Nothing about this makes any sense whatsoever. But even as this team is constructed, right? Because I mean, and this is where this gets to be fun to me. When they had Chris Paul, even with all the drama they were talking about having, they had a legitimate chance to still win the West, or at the very least be one of the three best teams in the West. They won two games against Houston in that series, right? And they won those two games against Houston. The Warriors still won the West. Portland did nothing in the conference finals to tell you that they were better than Houston. They probably walked out of last year as the second best team in the West. The Warriors then got dismantled. The big reason why we thought that team might not work with Chris Paul is just because they don't like each other. Now they've gone and gotten Russ, and I get the idea that the ceiling on Russ feels higher to them. But I'll ask you, Gabe, do you think Russ might be finished?
I think he's one of the top 10 players in the league. He's still got a couple years left at least.
When it's over, you won't know it until it's done.
Yeah, that decline's going to be really fast. As opposed to like Chris Paul, where we've seen him kind of gradually decline over the last couple of years, getting injured every postseason. I think with Russ, it's going to be like just one day, it's like, that's going to be it.
Did that day already happen? You just didn't know it. We're, what, 3-4 deep on the knee surgeries with him. The statistic that jumps off the page with me, with Russ, and that worries me, he went from being an 85% free throw shooter to being a 65% free throw shooter.
Yeah, but we talked about that. Remember, that was down to his free throw routine.
Oh, that's right. But I mean, what you going to do to fix it, homie? Right? The other thing, though, that gets me about him is that he is willing to dial back his game as the circumstances dictated. You can go look at the per game averages for him and look year to year. They're not really that steady. They do seem to be pretty dependent upon situations. But if he loses just a little bit physically, it all goes all the way downhill. The comparison that I've made for people is Allen Iverson in the 2008 season averaged 26 points a game for Denver. By the 2010 offseason, nobody really wanted to sign him, and it was abundantly clear as soon as he came back that he was finished. Now, to be fair, he was a couple years farther down the line than Westbrook was at that point, and in spite of the injuries, Westbrook has clearly taken better care of his body than Allen Iverson had. Allen Iverson was the classic, I don't lift weights, they mess up your jump shot kind of dude. Like, Allen Iverson's physical fitness regimen was playing basketball. That was how he did it. I play basketball, right? How do you work out for playing basketball? Just go play basketball. That's what it is. So perhaps Russ is a different guy there, but I'm just thinking about the way that the front office in Houston wants to play ball and the way that Mike D'Antoni sees it. Now, granted, the D'Antoni seeing it thing is tricky because they went from being the fastest team in the league when he was coaching the Spurs to being the slowest team in the league now that he's coaching the Rockets. But the shots that Russ takes, are those shots that are going to make Mike D'Antoni happy? Like, is Russ going to come down court, shoot that three, then look at Mike D'Antoni and be like, 7 seconds or less, baby. Thought that's what you was about. I don't know. Like, I simply don't have a great answer for how that's going to go, for, like, what the role is on that. None whatsoever. I just see the great potential for drama because that whole thing in Houston is built around James Harden. They have built that whole thing around keeping James Harden happy and stuff like that. Everything in Oklahoma City for the last 3 years has been built around Russell Westbrook. After Kevin Durant got up out of there, all of this was built around Russell Westbrook. You think Russell Westbrook about to come down there and be a passenger on the James Harden train? Right? Everybody's like, yeah, well, Russ and James talk, they cool. Didn't James Harden and Chris Paul talk before he got down there, and didn't they think everything was going to be okay? Now, part of this also that I think is interesting is that I'm big on nailing Daryl Morey for the idea that he doesn't get people stuff. Do you think he made this trade, Gabe? Because I don't think he made this trade.
He saw it as a way to get out of one contract that was really bad and exchange it for a contract that was as bad but maybe had slightly more upside.
Here's why I don't think he did it. He doesn't care about the people stuff, right? So Chris Paul and James Harden getting along, that doesn't strike me as something that's going to motivate Daryl Morey to make a move. And I don't know if you followed him on Instagram. He puts up all kinds of pictures that are trying to indicate, hey, everything's cool. Hey, everything's cool. Hey, look at this. Everything's cool. Like, he's been doing a lot of that stuff. He is classically the person whose life is going miserably, but they want to show you all the pictures on vacation and then smiling as big as they can. Right? Like, that's what it seemed to be. So to me, I don't think that he was going to let the idea that these two guys seem to have a little bit of beef make him make this trade to get a guy who, oh, by the way, has just as onerous a contract as Chris Paul does. If the issue is Chris Paul's contract, you went and got another version of it with a lot of the same pitfalls. So this sounds to me like a move that was made over Morey by the owner, because they got a guy who, again, plays a type of ball that's not in line with what Daryl Morey wants to do. You think Daryl Morey wants to be out there with Russell Westbrook and the shots that he takes? Yeah, you think that's what he's about? You think he wants a dude that shoots below 30% from three? Like, is that somebody that you think that Daryl Morey looked up and was like, nah, we got to get that? I don't see it. I don't see that at all. This seems to me to be, again, a slow walk of Daryl Morey to the end of his time in Houston. This is it. I'd also like to remind Daryl Morey that last time I checked, the Washington Wizards still don't have a general manager. You can go over there and get Brad Beal out of town and then build everything from the beginning. Like, I feel like, how often do you think that Tillman Fertitta sends an email to Daryl Morey that's like, I'm not sure if you know, but there's a job open. Might want to look into that.
Did you see that Tillman Fertitta is coming out with the book?
Did not.
For dramatic effect, search for the name of Tillman Fertitta's book right now.
Okay. Tillman Fertitta.
I'd tell you, but I want your real-time reaction.
I am here to give it to you, baby. Is this Shut Up and Listen? Hard business truths that will save your ass and help you succeed.
That's the one.
Wow. With the cover. Oh, man. Shut up and listen. Oh, I can't wait to read that. Right? Is he just going to be hollering at me all book?
Yeah, he's essentially telling you shut up and listen, me shut up and listen, Daryl Morey shut up and listen, Harden shut up and listen, everybody.
Wow. We should have made that the book club.
I had the same thought run through my head when I saw this yesterday.
Wow. Wow. Shut up and listen. That's what he is. So that's what he'd be telling Daryl Morey. Hey, put down that slide rule. Shut up and listen. I got some hard truths that are going to save your ass. What could go wrong, Gabe?
What a powder keg.
And now we've added Russell Westbrook to this. Oh, I'm here for it. I am here for it. So let's think about this. Let's go around the league right fast. How many teams have potential for, like, for real deal, highly entertaining drama? The Lakers, the Rockets, the Nets, because we still adding Kyrie. The Sixers, by the way, extended Ben Simmons. I mean, I thought Ben Simmons was going to play this out, but he decided to stick around and get that money. We've always got potential for it there, because Ben Simmons is not the easiest guy to like, and neither is Joel Embiid, and they all play together. Am I missing anybody on the high drama potential program?
Well, with the Celtics,
oh yes,
the point there has always been, oh, it's Kyrie's fault, oh, it's Kyrie's fault. Well, insert Kemba.
Yes.
We'll see if it actually was Kyrie's fault.
Well, the question to me in Boston is going to be, is Brad, how much of an allowance is Brad Stevens going to make for the fact that he's an NBA coach? And what I mean by that is, Stevens wants to run this everybody touch the ball offense that works very well when you're coaching at Butler and you got a bunch of mid-tier recruits. But to me, the NBA, your job as a coach is to run the system that gets the most out of your best player. Your best player now looks like he is Kemba Walker. Kemba Walker, you get the most out of him by putting the ball in his hands and figure out ways for him to attack. And these other dudes got to figure out a way to work around that, except they got a squad of dudes that ain't really trying to work around. So, okay, let's add them. We up to four. And then we just have teams that I think also interesting in the league now are teams that are probably not going to win a championship, but are still just kind of legitimately interesting, but interesting in a benign way. Oh, I forgot. Great potential for drama in Dallas. But Porzingis coming back.
And can't forget about Golden State. I mean, what if everything goes bad and they trade Draymond?
Oh, forgot about that. We do have that. Or Draymond starts feeling like he ain't going to get his money. Great call, Gabe. Is there Clipper potential drama? Can that be drama?
I mean, well, what if, like, I could see the drama amongst the fans if both Kawhi and Paul George get hurt and don't play.
Ah, good point.
And then the front office starts to panic.
Yeah. The Pelicans. Oh, I tell you, I met Zion this weekend.
You did? Interesting.
Yeah, I was walking out the hotel. I went to Vegas for the weekend. I'm walking out the hotel, and we see Zion's family and talk to them for a little bit. Yo, man, that is a really big dude. Like, I understand that feels kind of self-explanatory, except when you see Zion out there, he's not taller than everybody because he's on a basketball court. Yo, man, my head, like, the top of my head is coming up to his chin. I'm 6'4". Like, the top of my head is about coming up to his chin, and we dapped him up and he brought me in. I was like, oh, boy, you're quite the sturdy young man. I also felt so old because it was just so clear to me when I talked to him, holy smokes, man, this dude is 19 years old.
Did he know who you were?
Yes. his dad. We saw his dad first, and his dad, like, saw Mike, and then I was with Mike Smith. He saw Mike, and he saw me, and we talked to his mom. Yeah. Now, he knew who we were. He was the guy that smiled and all that, but you got to think about this. Like, with a dude like Mike Smith, been on TV as long as Zion's been alive, basically. Like, Mike been doing this ESPN stuff for, like, 15 years. Zion is 19. He don't know a world without Mike Smith. That's how old we are, Gabe. That's how old we are. Serena Williams got to the Wimbledon final where Simona Halep came out victorious. I tried to flip that phrasing on that, Gabe, because I ain't want to say Serena Williams lost in the Wimbledon final because that kind of ignores that he'd won something. I mean, she'd won something, rather. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So I want to be like, yo, she got to the final. She did not win. Talking about Serena Williams can be kind of tricky from where we stand just because, like, I can say this only for me. I don't know about you. Like, how much tennis do you watch?
I watch all the majors.
Okay. We kind of helicopter in. You know what I mean? I don't follow tennis enough to really give, like, super breakdowns on what Serena is versus everybody else. But what we do is we pop in to talk about Serena, and we never really talk about her in the context of the other players. We think about her in the context of greatness, because now we pop in and be like, oh, Serena's about to tie Margaret Court. Oh, Serena's about to, you know, X, Y, and Z. But we don't really know what's going on with the rest of these folks. We don't know. Do you know who the number one seed in the tournament was?
Yeah, I want to say her name is Ashley Barty. She's from Australia.
Oh, good for you. I didn't. I thought this Halep woman was the number one seed in the tournament. I got no idea. And so that happens as Serena marches through these tournaments. Apparently, she didn't play anybody who was a top 30 player until she got to the final, and then got smoked in the final once she got there. And again, also to be fair to Serena Williams, the last time she won a major championship, what was that, the Australian Open 2 years ago, when we found out that she was pregnant? Like, yes. I feel like, yeah, that's the last time that she won a major tournament. Obviously didn't play anymore that year, didn't win any last year, hasn't won either of the first three this year. That's not really some giant drought in terms of winning championships, right? Like, that's not a clear, obvious sign that she's finished or anything like that. But we don't tune in to watch her play. We tune in to watch her win. We tune in to watch her be the champion that we've always known her to be. And she's also kind of in that Brett Favre place where after a while, somebody plays so well as they age that you think they're never going to age. But then you stop and remember that Serena Williams is 37 years old. Like, we're asking for a lot of her to even get the level of greatness that we get from her now as a player. We're asking for a lot if we expect there to be a little bit more. But I think that we all just kind of assume that she would get to that 24th major title. She would tie Margaret Court. The more I think about it, man, that isn't promised. Like, it's just not. It's kind of like how we thought we were assured or we were certain that Tiger Woods was going to get to that 19th major, even 18. No, that wasn't a promise. Like, I remember after Tiger came back from the car wreck, I was saying we need to wrap our minds around the idea that he might never win another one. If we get that other one, we need to treat it like the party that it is. But we were lucky to get that one. It's entirely possible that we're not getting anything else from Serena, and that's fine. But something happened after that match. Did you see the guy that I didn't get the full context because I was doing the vacation thing. You see the guy that asked her, what do you say to those people who say that you should stop worrying about these causes and just focus on tennis?
Yeah. And what was most surprising about it to me was it was via comments that were made by Billie Jean King. She had said that Serena maybe needs to focus more on tennis.
I did not realize until yesterday that Billie Jean King was like the point of origin on those comments, because that seems a little off-brand, right?
Really? I'm taking a shot from you. We're supposed to be all together here.
Yeah, like
we're supposed to be supporting one another.
Or like, I thought this is something you would do.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah, no. That one is wild off-brand that it was there. And I guess now that once I knew that Billie Jean King was the point of origin, the question didn't seem nearly as silly. Because at the time, the question did seem to be silly. But that is, if it's Billie Jean King who says it, then you got to answer for it. Because my immediate thought on that was, one thing I don't like is when people wrap up somebody else's, like, basically this is your own question, but you're like, what do you say to critics? You know what I mean? And it's like, you ain't talking about critics, you talking about you. In this case, we are talking about a fairly significant critic, and this is on the matter of equal pay. I was stunned that that would come up in that way at that time, and I don't believe that there's any evidence whatsoever to indicate that her wanting equal pay at all is interfering with her playing tennis. Like, I don't see that, especially considering both she and her sister have had such a broad, diverse set of interests since they came in and seem to have been healthier people as a result of doing that. But they both had such a broad set of interests that of all the things to look at them and be like, maybe you need to cut that out. The trying to do better for people is the one that you think that needs to be knocked down. Are you serious? This to me is just some of the difficulty and frustration that comes from talking about Serena Williams in public, especially with my job. It's really, really hard. Like, did you read the first person thing that she wrote in Harper's?
I did not.
Okay. I think it's worth, I mean, I thought it was worth reading. I thought that she made some interesting points and, you know, thoughts on some different matters. And I did think it was like the way she talked about calling Naomi Osaka and apologizing to her for the way things went at the U.S. Open last year, and how it interfered with Naomi Shine. But somehow Serena Williams still thinks the way that she behaved at the U.S. Open last year was defensible. And she wrapped it up in this whole idea that, well, as a woman, you don't get to express your frustration. Why don't I get to express my frustration the way that men get to express their frustration? Let me walk around this office and start breaking a bunch of shit. And you tell me if they just going to be like, hey, man, he's just a man. So, like, maybe I'm off here because I'm a black dude and I feel like I am kind of boxed in by some of the same things that she's maybe talking about. And so maybe there's some white man that's like, yeah, I be breaking stuff at work all the time and don't nobody trip. I honestly have no idea. Like, for me personally, it doesn't work that way. But there's no way that she or anybody else is going to sell me that how far it went with her was okay. Like, I don't believe that that was the overarching patriarchy that was really shutting her down. Now, what I do think that was, in part, was the tennis world specifically picking on Serena Williams. Like, that I do believe happened. Like, when they got her on the thing with her coach and him doing the coaching from the stands, the problem, again, there, us helicoptering, or at least me helicoptering in on tennis, I don't know how much coaching people really do from the stands, and I don't know how different his level of coaching was from anybody else's, even though he was very obviously coaching. Like, there's really no way around that. He was obviously coaching her. Her argument was that she wasn't looking at it. He certainly expected you to, because he was up there coaching when all of that happened. Like, okay, you know, you say that wasn't what it was. Okay, cool. The thing at that time was, I don't cheat. I'm a mother. I would never do that. Man, you act like my mama ain't never lied to me. Gabe, your mama ever lied to you?
That has happened.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what it is. Like, come on now. Somebody's mama work at your job right now, and she lied to you 5 minutes ago. Like, come on, man. That's not how this works. That's not the game that we're playing here. So, like, for me, it was rough in reading it because I was like, you make some good points, but I just don't think that this is the example that speaks to the overall macro issue that absolutely does exist. I've seen some people whose response was like, well, you see, Kyrgios does this stuff and people just shrug. No, they don't. Like, at least not in my business. I don't know anybody that just shrugs off that foolishness that Kyrgios engages in. We all think he seems to be ridiculous. And so where I talk about the difficulty in talking about Serena Williams is it's never about what actually just happened with Serena Williams. It's not. It's about something larger that comes in. And that's why I kind of, like, when I talked about her losing that, or not winning that Wimbledon final, even then, that discussion is more about the will you get to 24 than it is about the match itself. I feel like from what people have told me from watching the match itself, it raised some questions for you as to whether or not this is just Father Time showing up as Father Time shows up for everybody else. But since we don't talk about her in the present tense, since we don't talk about her in the micro, everything is in the macro. Even when she was there talking about herself and what happened with that tennis racket, you know, with that tennis racket smashing and everything else in that match, it wasn't really about what happened there. It was about this macro. Why can't I express my frustration the same way everybody else expresses their frustration? And so I don't know when exactly this happened. I don't know. Maybe we've never been able to just talk about Serena Williams and it actually be a discussion about Serena Williams, right? But now I feel like whenever it comes up and it's time to talk about her, she is simply an avatar onto which so many people project a million different things they may be thinking or they may be feeling. That's what they do. That's what she becomes. And the truth is, looking at her now, it's maybe, just maybe possible that what's happening is she is now playing tennis at 37 years old better than anyone has ever played tennis at 37 years old. But that don't change the fact that she's playing tennis at 37 years old. And I just say that for everybody so that if a decline is in effect and if that decline continues and accelerates, can we at least try to talk about that as a micro level situation? Because with everything that's gone on with Serena Williams, here's what we've never had to do. We've never really had to talk about her as a struggling tennis player. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying she's a struggling tennis player right now. After all, she just got done, you know, playing to the Wimbledon final. I'm not saying she is, but I'm saying there's a possibility that that's going to happen, as it happens to so many people. Maybe she walks away first. I have no idea, but there's a possibility that that's the place that we're approaching. And I'm telling you, man, it's going to get ugly because there's so many people who've been waiting so long for that to happen. And on the other side, a bunch of people who are willing to physically fight you in the name of Serena Williams. Good luck with that. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about a problem in youth basketball. But first, summer is here and you know what that means. Barbecue season. And if you're like me, you'll be serving your friends and family the incredible meat from ButcherBox. I got a box of meat from ButcherBox and it was incredible. The ground beef, the chicken breast, all of that was fantastic. Grass-fed beef to free-range organic chicken to wild-caught sockeye salmon from Bristol Bay, Alaska. ButcherBox has over 20 different cuts of meat with customizable boxes and a variety of other options to choose from. They work closely with the best farms and companies committed to raising animals humanely. This ensures not only an ethical process, but one that results in a better quality, better tasting, nutrient-dense meat with no added hormones or antibiotics ever. ButcherBox is delivered right to your door with free shipping, and a month's worth of meat from ButcherBox comes out to less than $6 a meal. Whether you're cooking for all your friends or family or just yourself, ButcherBox has the cuts and options you need to make every meal a memorable one. And ButcherBox is making sure you have burgers for all your barbecues this summer season. They're offering new members who sign up at ButcherBox.com/Bomani $20 off their first box, plus 6 free burgers in every box until October 15th. That's ButcherBox.com/Bomani for $20 off your first box, plus free burgers in every box until October 15th. ButcherBox.com/Bomani. All right, Baxter Holmes, writer for ESPN, he wrote a story. It's long, it's thorough, I think it's very interesting, I think you should check it out, and he talks about what is a youth hoops crisis. Basically, the crisis is these kids' bodies are falling apart. That's it. The crisis is that these kids' bodies are falling apart, which is basically to say, that we're overworking these kids, man. Like, I sent this, one of my buddies, I believe you heard me talk about him before. He's got a giant child who plays basketball. And so here's what cats are doing now with these kids. Like, my man's kid, like, for real, they, like, you know, when they look at the x-rays and all that stuff, they think he's probably going to be about 7 feet tall. Now, there was a time where you thought the kid was going to be 7 feet tall. All you said was he's going to play basketball. You didn't have to put nothing in on it. But what people are going to do now is they got him playing ball. He's about playing against kids like 2 years older than he is, because that way he doesn't just get forced to play close to the basket. And this is how the kids start working on their perimeter stuff. Gave these 9-year-olds a Euro stepping, bruh, like ill Euro stepping. They're doing a zillion things that none of us ever would have thought that they would be able to do. But they play so much basketball. They are on so many planes. They are in all these places doing all this stuff. And so what they're saying now is by the time these guys get to the league, like even the like guys playing as, you know, coming out after freshman year, their bodies have so much wear and tear on them. Like, I remember a buddy of mine worked as a scout for a team. He had just gotten a gig. And he hit me up during draft season. He was like, dog, these dudes got, this is in the NFL to be clear. But he's like, dude, these guys got miles on them. Miles. And so by the time they're getting to the league, they have already done so much damage to their bodies. So much. But here's the thing, and this is why I found this to be interesting. forget about the ones that go to the NBA for a second. What about the kids who don't? Like, not all of these kids who are putting in all this work in these summers and playing with these AAU teams the whole way, they're not all going to the NBA. In fact, I'll take it a step further. They're not all getting college scholarships. And if they do, they're not all going to be starters. There's a whole lot of these dudes that are going to have miles on miles on miles on the back end and not have the $1 million salary that should come with it. Which leads me to ask this question. Now, I am not a parent, and I try to be very careful about the fact that I'm not a parent, because y'all out here playing a different game than me, and I recognize this. I just want to know this. Do people do this stuff for their kids or involving their kids because they think it'll make their kids happier? Like, I don't have the answer for that, but I'd like to know if some people could reach out in some ways about this. Is putting your kids into this in the ways that we're putting them into it, is it actually making them happy? Because I think what happens with a lot of people, and again, you tell me if I'm wrong here, but I think most people want to be great at something. And when they look up and they see the potential or possibility that their child could be great at something, and if they view themselves as not actually being great at something and wishing to have been great at something, they feel like the opportunity for the kid to be great at something is something that they got to do. Like my man that's got his kid playing ball. I remember what he told me. He was like, look, man, I'm doing this for two reasons. Number one, we got to try, right? Like you get a 7-footer, you kind of got to see where this might go. Totally got it. The second thing that he told me, though, was he's like, I'm doing this for confidence, you know, and I have witnessed with my own eyes what is happening with this young man. And he is definitely more confident as a result of playing ball, you know, because otherwise you that tall, you the Jolly Green Giant if you're not hooping, you know. So like, OK, I got that. Like I understood where he was coming from in terms of doing that. But I'm just telling you, happy is a weird thing. And being great at something, it ain't really necessarily the path to happiness. So like, I'll tell you a little story. When I was a teenager, my mom got the bright idea to maybe send me to go see a therapist. And to be clear, it was a bright idea. It was a great idea. It was one of the best decisions anybody ever made for me that she did. And so this is when I'm, I guess, 12, maybe 13, like somewhere in there. And so I'm in this awkward place of being like this really, really smart kid, but there's no good place in the social order when that is your thing. And I do remember something that the therapist, after I met her the first time, I remember she sent me home and she was like, I want you to go watch Amadeus. You ever seen Amadeus, Gabe?
I have seen that movie.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, she sent me to watch that. But what she thought, or her thought process on that, was just kind of the idea of the prodigy. And I don't think, I'm not Mozart or nothing, just to be clear. But you know what I mean? Like, it was just kind of like to see that, you know, and all the things that come into that notion. And I feel like if you watch that movie, you like, stop and think about it for a second. Mozart, not really happy. Michael Jordan, not really happy. We could go through a long list of these people who are excellent at something, perhaps the best in the world at whatever that thing might be. Not happy. Now, if you get to like the upper reaches of this basketball thing, what your kid can get is rich. And as a result, I guess it's worth noting, so can the parents. But there's rich that people can get to if they ride this thing all the way out. There absolutely is. You can get rich. I can tell you this firsthand. Rich ain't no proxy for happy. That's not how it goes. Rich is better than poor, but rich ain't no escape. Doesn't work the way I think a lot of people do. And so it just got me to thinking about like the way that we view youth sports. Be it like somewhat as a means to an end, a lot of it as a ways for parents, I think, to indulge some of their more selfish impulses under the guise of doing it for their children. You know, there's a lot of like the Joe Jackson situation, right? Musician who never got to blow up the way that he thought he should have blown up. So he pushed his kids like hell to make it happen. And then it did. But Michael Jackson looked like a happy person. right? Like to me, all those things just kind of tie together. And so to read that story and see what this physical toll is that so many people are putting on their bodies, and it's a gamble. Like those miles they're putting on their hips and their knees is not guaranteed to lead to the success they think they're going to get. So what's going to happen on the back end is a lot of these kids are just going to have broken down bodies working at regular jobs. And you got them playing so much in one sport. Like forget about, you know, not even just like the specialization argument, but you got them in just one activity that's going to work at the detriment of all these other things. When, by the way, your kids should probably be reading some books. You might want to have your kids read some books. Talk to some of your college professor friends if you got them. Your kids don't read enough. Bet they can hoop, though. We about to have the best hooping generation of kids ever. Right? Gonna be all kinds of people who ain't got no reason to be able to do all that fancy dribbling. Like, yo, man, look at this. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah, that's cool, partner. But the man say if we don't get these boxes out of here on time, we all getting fired. So, like, what exactly is it that we are doing? What exactly is it that people are going for? How in the world did all this stuff get to be so important? Well, it got to be so important because the money got to be so big in professional sports that it changed the odds on the gamble that you are making. And the chance of great financial success is greater than it was 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, all of that stuff. But I have no evidence to indicate that this is making anybody any happier. I just don't see it. And if it ain't making you happier, I think it's a fair question that you got to ask yourself about whether or not this is the thing that you actually want to do, if it is not something that is creating a level of happiness. So I imagine that greatness feels spectacular, but I also bet a lot of people get it, and it just don't feel like they thought it would.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story is a very interesting one. I'm not going to categorize it for you. You'll just have to laugh about it.
Hi, Bomani. This is Hannah Sparks, and I'm a features reporter with the New York Post. So last week, I stumbled on this Facebook event called Storm Area 51, They Can't Stop All of Us, and it's shaping up to be a sort of Burning Man for conspiracy theorists. The page itself has attracted gamers, millennials and Gen Zers, and just meme lovers. It's mostly been a forum for alien-themed jokes. Even the event details make it clear that they are not serious about storming Area 51. They plan to get together a squadron of Kyle's hopped up on Monster Energy. That's, of course, referring to a meme persona who, for lack of a better word, you'd describe as sort of trailer trash. And also a, quote, can I speak to your manager, Karen's, who, if you're on the internet, you know is the image of a white lady with short, spiky hair who is not here to play. So there's now even official merch associated with the event. A $20 t-shirt saying, I survived Area 51. All the aliens. There haven't been any official updates on the event itself because, of course, this is a joke. Area 51 is heavily guarded with U.S. military personnel, and as the signs say around the perimeter, use of deadly force is authorized. There's even a post saying, hello, U.S. government, this is a joke. I do not actually intend to go ahead with this plan. I just thought it would be funny. But considering the event now has over 1.2 million RSVPs in attendance, the feds felt the need to weigh in. So earlier this week, Laura McAndrews of the U.S. Air Force told the Washington Post, quote, Area 51 is an open training range for the U.S. Air Force, and we would discourage anyone from trying to come into the area where we train American armed forces. The U.S. Air Force always stands ready to protect America and its assets, end quote. And I think this statement really could only reveal that by assets, she must be referring to those hostage aliens.
Yo, doesn't that seem like a horrific idea, even if you could? I love that they're like, yo, just so y'all know, we will shoot you. They are letting you know this right now. We will shoot you. To the people who are thinking about going to Area 51 like that, okay? I feel like I know what they look like. Gabe, do you feel like you know what they look like?
Yeah, I can imagine.
A broad idea, right? I feel like I got a broad idea about this. All right. Let me tell you folks right there, because those of y'all that's thinking about going to Area 51, How about this? I ain't got to say what you look like, but I feel pretty confident that you don't look like me. Right? We good. Feel pretty confident that you don't look like me. Okay? They only kind of come out and tell us that they will shoot us. The people who are willing to shoot us if it comes down to it. Right? Like in the moment, they'll tell you, hey, I will shoot you. Assuming that they don't just shoot you first. But they will tell you, hey, I will shoot you if it comes down to it. But they don't just be really making broad proclamations to us to tell us that they will shoot us. These people are telling y'all that they gonna shoot you. And let me tell you something. It ain't gonna be with no pistol. It's gonna be like something off of Narcos if you lucky. Maybe something out of one of them movies like Independence Day. But they will. You got a better chance breaking into a Brinks truck than you do running up on Area 51. Yeah. And if you got counterfeit money in your pocket, they're going to shoot you, and then they're going to put you under the jail.
Under the jail.
That's right. But the ceremony might be nice, pretty box and everything, but they will smoke you. Please believe that. And by that, I mean the aliens.
This second story comes from Public Transit Metro.
Hi there, this is Henry Grabar. I'm a staff writer at Slate. Last week, I wrote about a working paper published by the National Bureau of Economic Research. It was undertaken by researchers at New York University and at Facebook. What they wanted to do was map the social network in New York City. So they got all the anonymized zip code level connections from all Facebook users in all 35 counties that stretch from Pennsylvania to Connecticut and comprise the largest definition of the New York area. They wanted to find out where friendships exist and where people know each other and how that relates to the geography of the city. And what they found was that out of all the geographic factors, distance mattered a little bit in determining relationships. The cost of a cab ride was slightly more important as a determinant, but even more important than that was public transit time. Greater public transit time was associated with a 14% lower degree of social connectedness between people. And that seemed to be even more true when the neighborhoods had different income levels. So public transit being a particularly important link to maintaining social networks across different types of neighborhoods. Now, we don't know if this means that people make friends because they live on the same transit line as other people, or if they live on the same transit line because they already know people in that area and that's what's driving this. But it's probably a little bit of both. So in short, fast transit, fast friends.
Here's what they're telling you. Transferring trains is really, really inconvenient. That is the moral of that story right there. You would be amazed the walking people are willing to do just so they don't have to transfer trains. And when I talk about transferring trains, here's the thing. There ain't that many places where you wind up switching trains. But if it is a place where you wind up switching trains, that means there's going to be a whole lot of people that are getting off there to switch trains because we all got the same idea. We don't have to be going to the same place. We just got the same general idea that we are going to be changing trains. Very few of the places where you transfer a train. And I don't mean like getting from a local to an express. I mean to getting onto a different line, right? Those stations where you do that are typically the most hectic ones. And I'm just saying right now, if you have ever, for any reason whatsoever, had to transfer at Times Square and get on the 2, you will do whatever it takes to just ride one train. You ever try to do that, Gabe?
I haven't. I don't live in the city, so when I go down there, I don't mind necessarily having to transfer trains.
Yeah. But see, here's what I was thinking, though, right? Because, like, I know the trains that y'all take to get in, that'll, like, put you to Grand Central.
That's correct.
It's possible that you could wind up in a situation where you take Grand Central, take the shuttle from Grand Central to Times Square, and then you have to go catch the 2 because a lot of things are off the 2. Like, that could happen. And if you ever have to do that one time, young man, you will never want to transfer a train ever again. And that is what I take from that story right there. Because they said transit time, but it really also sounds like the thing is transit line. Like staying on the same train. Because I'm telling you, man, if you live on one of them lines, that's one of them funny letters. Bruh, I don't know nothing about you. I came out of uptown. We'll come uptown. The A, the A, the B, the C, the D, the 2, the 3, the 4, the 5, the 6. If you're on one of them other letters, I don't know nothing about your life, man. That's too much work.
Every trip that I take out to JFK where I've got to change trains a couple of times to make sure that I get it out there with my suitcase is quite a hike.
Hey, man, I can't imagine taking the train to JFK. JFK, let me tell you how far JFK is, man. I went to JFK to catch a flight the other day, right? So I'm leaving from the job. Job's lower Manhattan. We go over to JFK. It took an hour, 15 minutes, and we never got on the freeway. I took a tour of Brooklyn because I don't have no spatial idea of that stuff. We was rolling through Bed-Stuy. We rolled down Marcy. I feel like we rolled past the Marcy Projects. I feel like we went through Fort Greene. I feel like we went through every single place in the New York City that is not the city. I feel like we went through all of it getting to JFK. And for the first time ever, I have to say this. Don't judge me. I might get that Uber helicopter ride one time. I'm not even playing. I'll do whatever it takes to not have to do that again.
Yeah, see, the thing about the subway is if you know the right routes that you need to take, you could get there in less than an hour. You could get there in like 45 minutes. Even if there's like you miss a train or whatever, you still get there in about an hour or less, and it's only $2.75.
Right, and it costs,
beat that.
And it can cost you a bill to get out to JFK.
Yes, I do that instead.
Yeah, I don't blame you, but I think I'm going to catch the chopper.
I'm going to be interested to hear how that goes.
If I ever have to go to JFK straight from work again, I'm going to get the chopper.
All right, so this last story. This is a very interesting story coming out of Paris, and the reporter was not able to join us for today, so I'm just going to give you a little synopsis. So there's a French inventor that was showing off a jet-powered hoverboard during the annual Bastille Day military parade in France. And so this guy who's a former jet ski champion and army reservist was on the hoverboard that this guy was showing off, flying around above Bastille Day, not just on the hoverboard, but he was carrying a rifle as part of the military demonstration and like application of the hoverboard invention, and people are thinking that this could kind of be like the future of fighting and military and all that sort of stuff. I personally thought when I originally saw this that it was an unmanned like hoverboard and that this dude was a robot, and I was like, wow, that'd be really next level. But this is just like a hoverboard that's actually working. But I mean, that's where we are right now. We've got a hoverboard flying above Bastille Day with a dude who's got a gun as part of like a show of strength or what have you. Your thoughts?
Well, the other thing, man, about Europe is they got a different attitude about walking around with them big guns. Like at the airport, please understand, if something happens at the airport in Europe and they got to shoot you, if you survive, it'll be with less of you than there was before. They think big guns, narcos. That's what they about. They go like they're not trying to be, if it is, I think this is probably the best way to put it, because guns are not nearly as prevalent in their everyday society. Therefore, they don't really have like gun etiquette. And since they don't have gun etiquette, they're not really that worried about being polite about somebody having guns here. They just put it all up in your face. In the U.S., you're supposed to be chill about it. Nope, they're not doing that. I am made very uncomfortable by knowing that somebody's around here with a gun, just out here with a big old gun. I am not here for that. And that dude was on the hovercraft with that thing. No, we're not partying here anymore. You know how good that dude's aim got to be for me to be certain that he going to hit who he's trying to hit?
Dude looks like the Green Goblin up there flying around.
Yeah, like I feel like if you need to shoot somebody from your hovercraft, this situation is important enough that you ain't worried about collateral damage. I just got to make sure I get that dude. Whoever else goes down, okay, whatever. And that's not how I want to feel on Independence Day. Can you imagine getting shot with an AK-47? At a 4th of July picnic, and you ain't even do nothing? Because that's what we're talking about here.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bo. So you were out of town this past weekend, but you missed quite the big blackout in New York City, and people were all over social talking about the crazy things that were going on. People were getting married in the dark and, you know, taken to the streets and singing and all this other sorts of New York-y type stuff. So we put out for people to send us their voicemails of crazy stories that happened during a blackout or some other sort of crazy situation and how they dealt with it. This first one is from Edison in Tennessee.
Hey, Bomani, I'm Edison from Tennessee. My senior year, there was a snowstorm, and the power went out. My grandparents lived with us. My dad told me to drive them to my aunt's house because she still had power. Now, between our houses is three steep hills and a highway, and I'm 18, and I've never driven in the snow. It took me half an hour to get to my aunt's and then 45 minutes to get back because it's uphill. Bo, not even 20 minutes after I get home, the power came back on and my dad told me to go get my grandparents.
Dog. Gabe, you ever had to do that?
It has happened to me many a times.
Oh, that's right. You live in Connecticut now. My bad. I was thinking about you being from California. I'm like,
yeah,
you live there.
Oh, boy. It has happened to me many a times when I've had to drive through the snow to X place or that place. The worst part about this story that I thought was that after everything, after doing all that, he just had to hop back in the car and drive him back.
I was drove a car in the ditch in the snow. And I wasn't even like wilding. It just happened. And I got it out. Like, I wasn't, like, stuck in the ditch. I was in a position where I could get it out. But that's something, like, they don't train you how to do that. I guess if you live in a cold weather place, maybe is that a rite of passage? Your daddy or your mama take you outside and y'all learn how to drive in the snow? I got no idea. Because when you don't grow up in it, they basically just drop you there.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'd never driven in the snow before I moved out here. And all of a sudden, I just had to do it. This next one comes from Jermaine, South Carolina.
Yo, Bomani, Jermaine from South Carolina. I really appreciate the show and everything. I went to North Carolina A&T around, I think it was 2002. There was a really bad snowstorm came through, so everybody was trapped in their dorms as it was. And then the blackout happened, and the lights and everything stayed off for probably about 6 to 8 hours. There was definitely a slip and slide up on the third floor. The fire extinguisher let off in the stairwell, so it was all dusty and people could barely go up and down the steps. Me and my friends said it got a little too crazy in our dorm, so we said we'll walk across campus, maybe go to a corner store or something. We had to pass by the athletic dorm at that point, and they were definitely having a full-out snow fight inside of the dorm.
Hey, man, y'all start throwing snowballs in the dorm, I'm calling the police. Here's what I was also thinking. Did he say what time the blackout happened?
He didn't say what time the blackout happened. He was just talking about slip and slides being up inside.
Yeah,
like, what's going on there?
Yeah, I was thinking about other stuff.
Well, I mean, if you have a blackout at night, then it's not going to be as apparent.
All I'm saying is, I feel like, for better or worse, that blackout can help people rationalize some regrettable decisions.
Where were those stories?
Like, who? I mean,
people are hiding from these stories.
No, I'm just saying, people are like, yo, I mean, it'll be really, really dark. All right. Oh, well, we ain't doing nothing else, right? Y'all been stuck. It's college. Y'all been cooped up all day long, and now it's a blackout. That is the ultimate. Hey, man, I better in the club. I ain't get to talk to outside. There's great potential for a lot of people to be like, yeah, I guess. Because I feel like that's exactly where that went for a whole lot of people. Like, how many people out of nowhere wound up being like, yo, how come such and such ain't here for the fall? I mean, I'm just saying, like, this is...
She's just visiting for the weekend.
Yeah, this is how those things go. This is how it works. I don't know. I'm assuming they got co-ed dorms at this point at A&T. But if they didn't, oh boy, that back door be open. A whole lot of people that's going to be making the moves. Man, that sounds like all the fun.
This last one is from Ed in Florida. It's not quite as funny, but it's pretty extensive.
Hey, this is Ed from Florida. Talk about a story we had back in 2005 or 6, I believe. This was Hurricane Wilma. We lost power for about 2 weeks. And the first week was cool because we got the grill off the gas grill. We had power coming out of cars, so we can always charge the devices in our vehicles. Wasn't too big of a deal. All the neighbors came out, so you got to know who the neighbors were because you didn't know that you had so many neighbors that were close by that you knew because no one's ever outside because we had AC and we had our electronics. But the moment the power went out, things got wild. And then a week passed, and after a week has passed, we started running out of gas. We started running out of gas in our cars and also gas in our grills. So then we had to start being creative. Also, gas was very difficult to come by after a week, So in South Florida, we actually had to drive north up to like Fort Pierce, Port St. Lucie, which is about 50 to 60 miles north, just to put gas in our car because our gas is running out because we're using the vehicles as charging devices for all of our electronic devices. That was funny. So we had to travel up there and we had to get some gas because local gas was closed, or folks was doing this thing where they was just all getting gas poisoning because they're all sipping gas from the cars to steal to other vehicles. So that made things a bit more difficult. Another thing that was pretty interesting was grilling, because in the beginning we had our gas grills. It was cool, but not everyone has coal grills because, you know, everyone was in old school back then using coal. So then we had to sort of try to improvise and say, okay, we don't have a coal grill, but what happened is that in the hood we had a bunch of shopping carts. So what we did, we'd get a bunch of coal, we flipped the shopping carts on its side and started grilling on the side of shopping carts. And I can tell you, it's been one of the best barbecue I've ever had in a long time. It's great barbecue, and I don't regret it for the world. So Hurricane Wilma, we were out for about 2 weeks. We had no power. It was Armageddon, but we grilled on shopping carts. We lived in our cars for AC and charging things. And also we got to know a lot of our neighbors more than we ever did. And once the power came back on, we acted like they never existed.
We were right back to, I don't know that dude.
There's some dedication to grilling there.
Yo, but what else could you do? Yo, like, I actually found that story to be low-key inspiring. because I have the thing, we almost had a hurricane hit. Like, it was wild. That hurricane just spent the whole night. Because, I mean, this is one where everybody was, like, getting out of town and holding up. But I didn't really, like, getting out of Miami when a storm hits, it's tricky because there's only one way out. Like, there's not a whole lot of directions that you can go when the storm comes to Miami. All you can really do is go north and west because it's all the way to the east and all the way to the south, right? There's nowhere for you to go. And so everybody's trying to get out in the same direction. So a whole lot of people wind up holding up. But the thing they tell you is get a tank of gas before it all shakes out, because they've learned over time. What happens is the gas stations go out for weeks. You can have a couple weeks where there's no gas station. Like, yo, man, it turns into some wild stuff when them storms hit in Miami. And the idea of no air conditioning in Miami sounds sweltering.
And meanwhile, you're using shopping carts to grill your chicken.
Yo, I told you, I am wildly impressed.
Yeah, it's next level.
All right. But ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We try to do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to our sponsor, ButcherBox. Also to the contributors for If You Haven't Heard. Thanks to Hannah Sparks of the New York Post. Check out her story about this so-called Area 51 raid. Dummies. Thanks to Henry Grabar of Slate. Check out his story on how the subway dictates social networks in New York City. And thank you to Gabe for getting us hip to game on what was going on with Bastille Day. Be sure to check out the Woj podcast this week. It chats with Rockets coach Mike D'Antoni about the Westbrook trade. Also, remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater, and we will talk to you later this week. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.